You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, February 8th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author, historian, professor of history at Columbia University, Eric Foner, on American radicals and the change we could believe in. Also on the program today, Elizabeth Warren, silenced, cannot participate any longer in the debate on Jeff Sessions because she read the words of Coretta Scott King on the Senate floor. Yemen tells Donald Trump, no more military invasions of our country, please.
We can accept some civilian casualties, but we can't accept complete incompetence.
That's right. If you can do any of that, let's do it by the air.
Yeah, meanwhile, actually, right.
Bernie Sanders squares off with Lion Ted. Meanwhile, one-third of Americans don't know that Obamacare is the Affordable Care Act. Republicans vote to eliminate the agency dedicated to protecting our elections. Sean Spicer exit watch is on, ladies and gentlemen. And Republican lawmakers apparently are very afraid of you. They're snowflakes.
You safe space.
The Army grants the Dakota Access Pipeline easement without a finished environmental impact study statement. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. All this and more. Some good news. Oh, I should also say I listened to the hearing yesterday, the oral arguments in the ninth. It was a panel of the Ninth Circuit Court. Two judges, and it's sort of a shame we have to say this, but this is the era we live in. Two judges appointed by, I believe it was Obama, one by Bush, and it was fascinating to hear the arguments. I'm unclear, frankly, on what's going to come out of it. I mean, it sounds like Washington State very well may prevail, but there were questions of standing, which I think ultimately Washington State prevailed, and I'm guessing now, and I don't know. But the Washington State attorney was also trying to make an argument that the venue for the restraining order on the stay, or I should say the stay on the restraining order, he believed was wrong. And that was second year of law school stuff, so I didn't fully follow that. It is clear that the judges appear to accept, at least for the purposes of a stay, that Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump saying that this was a Muslim ban, even after the election, has some evidentiary value to the proposition that this is a Muslim ban. Now, understand, there was two parts of this executive order. One was refugees, which basically said, we're not going to allow Muslim refugees, just Christian and Jewish and maybe Yazidi and any other religious minority from these seven countries. They didn't use the word Muslim. They didn't use the word Yazidi. They used the words, just coincidentally, whatever the majority.
What's that majority religion? Muslim.
What a coincidence. And in terms of banning any immigration visits from those countries, there's still an argument that the president hasn't provided any evidence as to a reason to do this. And the federal government was basically arguing he doesn't need to provide any evidence, you know, any reason essentially to do it. And the DOJ lawyer was not quite prepared to answer, like, well, what if this was just a, could he ban all Muslims? We also heard, I believe, I'm not sure from which judge, the question of like, well, look, these seven countries only represent 15% of the Muslim population in the world. How can this be a Muslim ban if it just bans the 15% of them? I don't think that was particularly well handled by the Washington. I mean, look, we have years and years of examples of voting restrictions being lifted in specific states because it is discriminatory towards blacks. It's not discriminatory to all blacks. Not even all blacks in that state. But it just so happens that there are certain populations that don't have as many ID, for instance, or so. You don't have to discriminate against every member of a class to be discriminating against a class. But we will see going forward. On
it also reveals their logic because they're like, no. We would actually like to be discriminating against all Muslims and all black people for that matter. The fact that we're not, if you're not doing the real full thing, I mean, can you really say you're doing it?
Exactly. Stop half-assing it, you racists.
Exactly.
Okay, anybody out there in human resources? HR folks? Listeners in my audience who manage resources that are human? Anyone? Well, I've got a special message for you. If you're an HR person, or maybe you've just got a small to medium-sized business, you got to hear about Bamboo HR. It's the number one HR management software for small to medium-sized businesses. It gives you one simple central system for keeping organized and detailed records for every employee and automating countless tasks in HR. No more file cabinets, no more spreadsheets, no more messy whiteboards. It's accessible through the cloud at any time from any location. Did you forget to log off an employee's time off? Forget they were out last Monday, Michael? Do you have an employee maybe?
Last Monday?
Well, I guess it was Friday. Yeah, I almost forgot.
Yeah.
Because you were drinking so much on Thursday.
Heavily. I had a great time.
Now, I don't know that Bamboo can help you with that.
I had a tremendous time.
So simple and delightful to use, you won't need any instructions. Everything in one place, job and salary history, vacation, sick days, fake sick days. I don't know if they have that. Benefits, onboarding, training history, performance reviews, and so much more. And now we have a limited time offer for you. Right now, you can try Bamboo HR free for 14 days. That's right. Kick the tires. Take it for a spin. Just visit BambooHR.com. Click on the microphone. Enter my code REPORT to get a 14-day free trial. Try it. You'll wonder how you ever got along without it. That's BambooHR.com. Enter my code REPORT. Also, some other good news. I don't know if that if the hearing on the ban will end up being good news, but a judge in North Carolina has blocked, at least for a temporarily, state law passed by the, you'll all remember this, the GOP the Republican law state house that strips the Democratic governor of some of the Democratic governor's powers. The law required Senate confirmation for the governor's cabinet members, which previous governors have not needed. And the law, you'll recall, was just approved about, 6 weeks ago, right after McCrory conceded, and 2 weeks before Roy Cooper took over. It was a three-judge panel, gave the order just before state senators scheduled a hearing with the secretary of Cooper's Veterans Affairs Department. So we'll see where that goes. But judge is going to be pretty important. You know, Donald Trump had a tweet, and I don't want to spend too much time, obviously, on Donald Trump's dumb tweets. But this one I found a little bit, they're all pretty disturbing. But, and he's talking, and we've got sound, and we're going to talk more about the ban, but he's talking about if the U.S. does not win this case, as it so obviously should, we can never have the security and safety to which we are entitled. Politics! Exclamation point. Now understand, and I tweeted this out, he's not complaining about politics here. He's complaining about our constitutional form of government. He's complaining about the fact that he's not our ruler, and there is anybody out there to question what he does. The other part, of course, is the sort of a similar threat that we heard from Dick Cheney. If you vote for John Kerry, you're basically giving Al-Qaeda the keys to the kingdom. I mean, he's setting up the courts to be the villain in the event that we are attacked, so that courts will have a much tougher time stopping him in the future. At least that's, you know, and I don't know how much he thinks this out, but the idea of calling this politics, no, it's the Constitution. It's the law. It's checks and balances. Just be aware of this stuff. For the most part, I think that, you know, look, you don't want to follow what this guy tweets all the time. It's going to drive you crazy. But also be aware of some of those more scary authoritarian things. I don't care what he says about Arnold Schwarzenegger and his ratings.
Right? We do have one that's a little bit more on a personal tip, but quite revelatory that we'll get to later.
Okay, good. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Eric Foner. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program Eric Foner. He is the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, author of many, many books, but most recently, The Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad, also author of Nothing But Freedom, Emancipation, Its Legacy, and Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877. Professor, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Good to talk to you, of course.
I want to talk a little bit about your piece in The Nation magazine of late, American Radicals and the Change We Can Believe In. But let's start with just the idea of does America today, or I guess let's even start with what is radicalism?
What is radicalism? Radicalism depends on the moment you're talking about. Things that are radical in one era become sort of common sense in another. In other words, I'm against positing a timeless definition of radicalism, like it has to believe in abolishing private property, or it has to believe in, you know, some other specific thing at any time, at any moment. Radicalism is the sort of, to my mind, the, you know, the left wing of the any particular social moment, and the people who are demanding fundamental change in the society. So it differs from reformism, liberalism, which wants incremental change, it wants more far-reaching change, but it, you have to analyze it in historical context. That's my point. And, you know, that article you mentioned was stimulated by my experience teaching a course at Columbia a year ago on the history of American radicalism, and it ran through 200 or more years of American history, but, you know, radicalism changed over time, and that's one of the points of the course.
Have we always had radicals in this country?
I mean, yes.
So they're always there.
They're always there. Every generation has them. They differ among themselves, obviously. Sometimes they fight among themselves, but this has been a persistent theme in American history.
I mean, I felt like the 90s were devoid. At least much of the 90s. I mean, and by the end, it seemed to there seemed to be some pushback there. But what was the radical movement in the 90s?
The 90s. The 90s was a pretty conservative decade, even though Clinton was in power, who's a lot more liberal than, you know, than Reagan, who came before him, etc. I think in the 90s, really, the key radical moment was at the very end of the 90s, the
WTO,
you know, the Seattle protests, and really putting on the agenda all these questions about globalization, about inequality, about climate change. You know, I think if you go back to 1999, I guess it was, the Seattle demonstrations really opened up a whole bunch of questions which became much more crucial in the 21st century that we're living in right now. You go back before that, you know, the 90s were a funny decade because with the end of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the end of communism in Eastern Europe, there was a kind of ethos, which obviously proved to be totally false, that history had ended, you know, as Francis Fukuyama said,
mm-hmm.
and that there was only one possible way of organizing life, that is, with democratic politics and free markets. It was supposed to be the era of democracy, and in some ways it was, although democracy seems to be on the retreat nowadays. You know, radicals were sort of, I think, quiet for a while because they were trying to come to terms with a completely new situation and figure out what radicalism should be in this very new political situation after the end of communism.
Let's talk about to give people a sense of the scope of what constitutes radicalism and mm-hmm. and you know, the abolitionists as radicals.
Yeah, I mean, I start with Tom Paine, who's sort of your quintessential American radical at the time of the American Revolution. You know, he said a share in two revolutions is living to some purpose. He was in the American Revolution, the French Revolution, a guy who completely challenged the existing political order, attacking monarchy, aristocracy, and also putting forward programs for economic equality, which were quite radical for the 1790s. You go up through the abolitionists. I put a lot of emphasis on the people who struggled against slavery for two reasons. One, slavery was deeply embedded in American life. It was not, you know, it was really the basis of the American economy for a long time. And it wasn't just a little footnote like we sometimes prefer to think. And the abolitionists really pioneered the sort of modern radical methods of how to change society, you know, going out and with pamphlets and petitions and speeches and newspapers, and you might almost say operating both above ground and below ground at the same time. They had all these public events and, you know, working within the system in that way, but they also violated the law. They helped fugitive slaves, which is very much against the law. They had this kind of underground activity also, the Underground Railroad, we call it. And so they kind of operated at both levels at the same time, and I think that's an interesting lesson for subsequent radicals, even today. You know, people who are opposing Trump's, you know, policies on immigrants, on refugees, are going to court, which is right within the system. But on the other hand, they're also, you know, offering sanctuary to people, saying we're going to help people who are banned by the government. whether that violates the law or just says we're not going to cooperate with the law, it is very much in the abolitionist tradition.
So I mean, if we're talking about radicalism as a dynamic, right, between the status quo and others' belief, I mean, when a person gets radicalized, right, by changing events, you know, because it seems to me that we've got two things going on here. On one hand, we've had a nascent, and then maybe one could look at this actually getting born at those WTO protests, and maybe then put on hold briefly because of 9/11 and sort of a pushback there, but then reemerging and particularly as a function of the financial crisis. We've got this sort of nascent movement on the left and particularly amongst the youth. And then we're then met with sort of these, I think what we could say is radicalism on the right, which
absolutely,
which could also radicalize a whole nother set of people, but not necessarily in the same way that those pre-existing radicals. Am I making sense here?
No, I hear what you're saying, absolutely. And, you know, radicalism exists on the right, and right now it's sort of obviously dominant in some ways, although the first couple of weeks of Trump's administration have shown the existence of a very big radical resistance tendency in the country, which I think is all to the good. I think the main point you're making is two things. One, radicalism tends to emerge in moments of crisis, you know, when the existing system seems to be delegitimized, such as by the financial crisis of 2008. You know, all the talk about how globalization was solving all our problems and everything was just hunky-dory, that became to be seen as ridiculous in lies. You know, we'd been fed lies for 20 years by our presidents and others about how wonderful the economy was working for everybody. And the crisis of 2008 sort of showed it wasn't. That opened the door to the delegitimation of the existing ideology, opened the door to new ones. There's no guarantee that they're going to go left, right, or any other direction. You have the Occupy Wall Street and movements like that, which, were much more on the left wing. And then you have the Tea Party and others, which and feeding into Trump's campaign, which go in a very different direction. So the sort of cracking up of the system does not necessarily lead in one direction, but it does open the door for new possibilities. And I think, you know, radicals of the left have to seize that opportunity, which exists today because of the crisis of 2008 and what followed.
And what of, though, the idea that I'm just to use slavery. Slavery is an institution that was, was embedded, fairly static reality there at the birth of the country through through the economic explosion of the country via cotton in many respects. And so if I'm a member of that society, I turn against that institution. What if that institution did not exist and then gets implemented by the status quo, which then radicalizes me? I mean, because that's what I'm saying.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. Historians have enough trouble figuring out what did happen than worrying about what didn't happen. But I think your point is, you know, what is it that makes people turn against an institution that is part of their life? It's normal. It's not that most people were pro-slavery. It's that they just took it for granted. It was part of society, you know? I mean, I often ask my students, well, go a century ahead, and what will people a century from now look back and say, how the hell could they have accepted this or that in 2017 as just a normal part of life? But, you know, it may be 100 years from now, something we think is a normal part of life will seem absolutely intolerable to people. And it's radicals who make it intolerable. In other words, it was the abolitionists, you know, who were a very small and often despised group at the minute, at the beginning. You know, one abolitionist editor was killed by a mob in Illinois. Their meetings were broken up by mobs. We shouldn't think that suddenly everybody turned around and said, oh, yeah, slavery is pretty bad. We got to get rid of it. It took a very long struggle to persuade a large number of Americans that slavery was, something that needed to be abolished. So, that's really the transition. seeing something that you have previously accepted as just a normal part of life and suddenly saying, no, no, this is intolerable and we have to get rid of it. What radicalizes people? It really depends. Sometimes it's an economic collapse, like in 2008. Sometimes before the Civil War, it's religious conviction. People go to religious revivals, and the preacher preaches against sin, and one of the sins he's talking about is slavery, and sometimes people wake up on that. Sometimes it's just encountering a fugitive slave and putting a human face on what is often an abstract institution. So, you know, there are many, many things that kind of galvanize people to think in new ways.
Without asking you to sort of divine the motivation or the intent of, like, people who are marching, I guess where I'm getting at to a certain extent is when people go out and march against Donald Trump, are they fighting for a radical vision of the country, or are they fighting for just a return to the status quo?
Or, I don't think they want the status quo, but I think...
The status quo that existed before Trump.
I think they know... right now, it's a lot clearer what people don't like than what they do want. We don't want what Trump is offering. And the people who mobilized the Women's March of hundreds of thousands of people, the demonstrations after the immigration ban, those brought together a lot of people with a lot of different ideas. They could unite in opposing what Trump is doing, but if you sat them down and said, what positive vision do you have for the future, I'm sure you'd hear a lot of different things. Radicalism has to move from, you know, saying no, which is important in a situation like today, to saying, okay, here is what we want to do and we want to have. And it's not just going back to the status quo. Many people were quite disappointed with the Obama administration and the status quo that preceded
right.
Trump. So, you know, I don't want to go back and have another Obama administration. And in a certain sense, that's one of the big reasons Hillary Clinton lost. She was just promising people another 4 years of Obama. And they were tired of what Obama was peddling for them. So we've got to have a positive vision, and it's going to take time to... develop that.
How does that develop? Because when I look at sort of when we've had those moments where radicals have won in many respects, it seems to me we're in an era where the amount of imagination we need to fundamentally change what people were rejecting from the Obama era and the era that preceded it is greater in many respects. And I don't know. I mean, I guess you would have a better sense of this, but it's one thing to say we want to abolish slavery. And then there were others who said, well, it's not just enough to abolish slavery. We actually want to have equal rights. I mean, and we're, you know.
That was the abolition position, and that's what made a lot of them unpopular. You know, there were plenty of people who were perfectly happy to attack slavery, but were also deeply racist, and they
right.
were worried about slavery's impact on white people. And to convince them that really the issue is equality, not just slavery, racial equality, justice for people, not just saying, okay, you no longer are a piece of property, important as that is, obviously. And to get the society even to take steps in the direction of genuine racial equality, which did happen in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War during Reconstruction, was a heroic struggle. I think if you, one of the lessons of this history, you know, history doesn't teach exact lessons, but one of them here is that, you know, all triumphs are kind of partial. In other words, radicals never get everything they want. They get something, and then they have to continue to struggle on other fronts and other issues. It's never, you never reach a point where you say, okay, great, we've got what we want, now we can go home and, relax. The issues are always out there. New challenges emerge. That's why it's a dynamic process, as you said.
You quote Gramsci, the old order has died, but the new one can't be born yet. Where are we on that spectrum?
Gramsci, the Italian thinker. Yeah, I mean, that's where we're at. We're in the middle of the death of an old order, which still exists like a vampire, you know. The old order of financialization of the economy, of globalization being the answer to everything, of, you know, human beings being just considered factors of production. You know, hey, if you lose your job in Ohio, well, just move to Silicon Valley and become a computer programming. And that doesn't hold water anymore, you know, if it ever did. So people have lost faith in that dominant idea of the 90s and early part of the 21st century. But what is the alternative? You know, to me, Trump is not offering an alternative. He's offering a lot of rhetoric and stuff. So radicals have to offer an alternative. What do we want? And how do we get there? You know, they're doing that on specific issues. We know we don't want this Muslim ban. We don't want to turn the clock back on the rights of women. But what we do want positively is still to be determined.
I mean, how does that happen? I mean, how does this is there an order for these things to happen?
No, I don't think there's any rule. I think what it has to do is come organically out of kind of grassroots movements. I mean, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement to me is a very important thing. It didn't, you know, nobody founded the Black Lives Matter movement. It wasn't like a group of leaders coming together and saying, okay, here's what we're going to do now. It came from the grassroots. It came from ordinary people just getting fed up with the way the police were treating African-Americans in community after community across the country. And, you know, people took to the streets, and, there's still plenty of problems with the police, but I think Black Lives Matter has actually had a very salutary impact in many communities on how they operate. But, you know, so there's a radical position which just developed organically out of people's struggles on the day-to-day level, and in a way that may be the best way for it to happen.
What is the means in which people can become sort of? To the extent that we more broadly in our society have that struggle, the idea of wealth inequality, the idea of stagnant wages, the idea of not having health care. I mean, this sort of development that we've seen around the world in many respects, at least for economies that are as developed as ours. We're not participating in that largely, right?
No, we are way behind the curve, obviously. Now, of course, plenty of those countries you mentioned have a lot of problems right now also,
sure.
But we are, we're an outlier in basic social health, social welfare, education. You know, we just don't do it in any adequate way.
In some ways, it seems like...
You know, but that's been a progressive program for 100 years. Go back and read the platform of the Progressive Party of 1912 when Theodore Roosevelt, the so-called Bull Moose Party, when Theodore Roosevelt, not a radical, but he ran on what was really a blueprint, his platform for 20th century, you know, social policy. And we haven't come up to what they were demanding in 1912. So, we got a long way to go on these issues. But then you have to ask yourself, is something more needed than just to list a couple specific things? Yes, we should have universal health care. Absolutely. Every other country in the world has it, at least advanced country in some form or another. Even Obamacare is way short of the mark. It was a step forward, but not adequate fully. The way we assist the poor is quite inadequate compared to other places. But those are, you know, I think one of the challenges is to move from those specific questions to a broader, well, what kind of broad changes in how our polity and our economy operates would be necessary to produce those things?
And, where can we find clues?
Where can we find what?
Clues to what? To
Yeah, we can find it in history. That's why I teach about the history. How did the abolitionists mobilize? How did the feminists mobilize? How did labor mobilize in the 1930s? We can't just go back and recapitulate what they did, but we can learn lessons from these different kinds of struggles. The first lesson is it takes a long time. The abolitionist movement was a movement over a century, maybe, depending on how you date it, or half a century. The struggle for women's rights from, you know, even the right to vote from 1848, Seneca Falls to 1918, 1919, you know, the granting of the right to vote in the Constitution. I mean, that's 70 years or something. So people have to look at this as a long-term project, not just, by next year we'll be solving these problems.
Do you have a sense, relative to Europe, it seems that Europe was ahead of us from sort of an, I guess, a social safety net, but less so in terms of empowering people who were not, I mean, having a more, I guess, heterogeneous society. I mean,
they don't. Well, now they're becoming more heterogeneous, right, and that has led to a lot of social tension, as we know. I don't say we have to just model ourselves on Europe. There are some aspects of European social democracy that are very valuable, and there are other elements of European society that I don't think we want to emulate. We can learn from other people. Obviously, that's one of the one of the things in American culture that is most debilitating is the notion that we're so exceptional that we have nothing to learn from anyone else, and that's just parochialism and closing your mind off. On the other hand, I think at some points in American history, like under the communist party era, there were people who were on the left who just said, well, let's just model ourselves on this other country over there, whether it's the Soviet Union or some other one. No, I don't think that's the way to go either. Every country has its own particular configuration and history, and we've got to figure out a solution within the context of American society, not just saying, let's plunk down what they have over there, here.
Is there a historical precedent for sort of the type of era that we're living in right now, where we have seemingly the majority of the country against
You mentioned my books on Reconstruction. I think we need to go back to then. In Reconstruction, you had a very forward-looking interracial democracy created in the South for the first time. The laws, the Constitution were changed to give African Americans equal rights, at least on paper. You had a functioning interracial democracy for the first time in American history. And then you had a backlash. Some people feel we are living in like 1877 again, where things were taken apart and things were rolled back. And, the lesson is, you can never take accomplishments for granted. Laws on the books are not enough. They've got to be enforced. You've got to live with them. So in a certain sense, I think I hope if we don't go through the whole post-Reconstruction process of the late 19th century, but we can at least understand this principle that rights can be taken away. We can't just rest on our laurels.
Indeed. Well, Eric Foner, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Very nice to talk to you.
Really appreciate it.
Okay. Very good. Bye-bye.
Good place to end. I think we were, I think I was quoting that, his last line, I think, which I had read in an interview at one point, sometime after this election. I mean, I think to a certain extent, the biggest analog is sort of that Jim Crow era in many respects, that pushback on Reconstruction.
There was a piece in the Times that came out last week, which would be a little bit less disturbing and depressing, which is that the analog is maybe 1990s California, where there was this, in terms of waves of immigration, and then there was this last backlash where Pete Wilson, who I guess he was governor in the 90s, built his career on doing stuff actually not that dissimilar to Trump. He targeted Mexicans. He ran on denying in-state benefits to the children of undocumented people. And then, of course, it was popular and effective at the time, but it actually laid the groundwork for California for all of its problems. It's definitely at least overall accepted that it's an immigrant state and sort of in some ways move forward on those things, at least obviously compared to the 90s.
Well, but then you had to go through all that shit with Gray Davis and the repeal, the recall.
Yeah, but that's a kind of
and
more.
Then
but that was
Schwarzenegger.
He got.
Is that what happens now nationally?
Yeah, like, Schwarzenegger becomes
president.
We get rid
of Trump and Schwarzenegger comes in.
He gets. Well, but I think Gray Davis didn't. That was. We were already moving because then he get blamed falsely for what Enron did to California.
There was a lot of the rolling blackouts. And
then by the time Schwarzenegger was in there, Schwarzenegger was...
The Ken and Ken show, I think, actually, in California. I'm not being...
Those
facetious.
Guys did it great.
Not those guys. Yeah, they're from
dude.
California. Different guys.
No,
and Darrell Issa largely financed that recall effort.
Imagine one day he's like, you know what? I think I'm going to stop, possibly committing arsons and collecting the insurance and fund a recall effort.
And he was very, very sad that he wasn't made governor.
Yeah. sad, pathetic. No, but and Schwarzenegger wasn't. He was terrible, but he did not have the same kind of anti-immigration politics that they had in the 90s at all. He had already stepped back on that.
He just
completely
didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
For him, it was all about, we're just going to cut stuff, and then he ran into a huge brick wall. Right. And
then randomly became an environmentalist.
He probably always was a little bit,
yeah.
I would bet.
Yeah.
It's a real shame Gary Coleman did not win that election.
Gary Coleman ran in that election?
Yes.
Jesus, man.
There was a lot of people who ran in that election. There was like literally like 23
you
people.
Mean like the TV figure?
Yeah.
When was that? Was that like 2004 or something like that? I remember I was watching a lot of Jay.
I feel like it was before.
You read the paper? You read the paper? So anyways, we got a big recall going on.
I feel like it was earlier than that.
Big recall. Greg Davis, the blackouts.
I feel like it was earlier than that. But I used to see Gary Coleman in a... he used to hang out in a Best Buy playing video games. I'm not kidding.
It was good prep for governor. Wasn't Gray Davis, like, wasn't he the type of person that would make like Al Gore look like
right.
Barack Obama?
Yes.
Like, wasn't he an exceptionally like an aptly named person?
Yes. Yes. Don't name your kids Gray.
He should have came out in a post 50 Shades world. Would have been.
Yeah.
It's a good thing because we were contemplating naming my child Bland and.
Bland Cedar. You know what? If with your genes and that name, that kid would have been so angry that they would have been entertaining. They would have fought against the name.
That's right. It's like a boy named Sue. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Oh, did I just throw out my...
Looks like it.
My sound sheet? Where did my sound sheet go?
Where did my sound sheet go? It's
all
over.
I'm going to need another one.
I don't know where it is.
Gonna need another one.
Hello.
We've got a lot of good sound, though.
Sound.
Elizabeth Warren. We will walk you through, and this is turning out to be a huge mistake for Mitch McConnell. Apparently, a rather unforced error and a weird one. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking because the whole letter was read. They didn't shut her down until minutes afterwards.
Oh, she's about to finish, and then this will just sort of all go disappear.
Well,
now I want to get on the Senate floor and fuck this up.
Well,
here I come.
I think there was a quality of like, we're going to try and punish her, and we're going to try and bully and intimidate her, and it backfired.
I'm triggered.
Big.
I'd like the Senate President to note that I feel that we're a safe space here.
Because we've had multiple senators now read the letter again on the floor, right? And
Merkley, Sanders, and Udall, I believe, so far.
As far as I know, they have not been censured.
And
so,
they've all, and you know, Bernie tweeted out, like, I just read it. I think Warren's, you know, owed an apology.
Yeah. We also have a segment of the Bernie Sanders and Lion Ted, the CNN debate last night.
How great would it have been if he went up in Ted's face just like those bikers, and he just stood there just like, Lion Ted,
Lion Ted. It would have been.
What about Goldman Sachs? What about your wife at Goldman Sachs? You want me to spill the beans on that?
He should have at one point just said like,
Lion Ted.
I want to thank you, Lion Ted. I'm sorry, I had to say it. I'm joking. Of course, I'm joking. You're not lying, Ted. I have respect for you. Yeah. You're not lying, Ted.
You're totally
just so he
not
could say it three
lying,
or four times.
Ted. Not lying, Ted at all. When
no.
people call you lying, Ted, I say he is not lying, Ted.
Not lying, Ted. So thank you, lying, not lying, Ted.
My new nickname, not lying, Ted. Along with my other one, I disagree, but you're incredibly likable, Ted.
And then there was also this interview with Jake Tapper and Kellyanne Conway. And CNN, for a couple of days anyways, had implemented the Cedar Doctrine of not having complete, obvious liars on their network. And then apparently Kellyanne Conway and Jake Tapper sort of made up. In what, when you hear this, it really does feel like... You're the third person at a really bad first date.
Like, and you'd somehow, but it's still going to end here? Up with them hooking up, which right. makes no, it no. even more disgusting.
There's definitely that type of tension going. But
I hate you so much. All right, let's get out of here.
Right, like this is like the that first date in Harry Met Sally, and you feel like in like 10 years, they're going to hook up again.
Ugh.
Oh, God. But now I so feel like I did my Dennis Miller, but there's no, they don't make movies like that anymore.
I've never seen that movie.
You haven't?
Dude, that is like a that is actually an 80s movie, right?
Is it really?
I mean, yeah.
I feel like it just can't. It's not as up to date as
it just came out.
I'm joking. It's not as up to date as Sleepless in Seattle, but I'm joking. Oh my God.
Didn't see that one either.
I'm sick, folks. I don't feel well. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. You can support this program by...
It's 1989. You're really close.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Sleepless in Seattle, still in the forefront of my mind because that was so... Such a big movie.
It's a big league fucking movie.
Oh, my God. It's... I'm trying to think of another movie from that era. I can't. Folks, your membership makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also leave us a review on iTunes. That's very helpful. You can go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off if you buy crap from Amazon or Jet.com. Least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this. Hey.